Department, United States v. Marlin. Mr. Crawford, are you first?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Jack Crawford. I'm a lawyer from Indianapolis, Indiana, and I represented defendant appellant Wesley Hammond at trial and on appeal. I am one of six presenters, with the Court's permission, on behalf of the defendant's appellants today, and my time is limited, so I would like to move directly to the argument, with the Court's permission once again, that I wish to address, which is whether or not the District Court erred in admitting the dual testimony of Special Agent Douglas Freiberger without sufficient precautions to ensure that that testimony was properly explained to the jury. As this Court well knows, this is an issue that has been developing over the years in this circuit, and the most recent case that I found was the Christian versus United States case, in which this Court once again stressed to the government that in using a witness as a both expert and fact witness, that the government is treading on thin ice.
Mr. Crawford, you know, your biggest problem, it seems to me, with your argument about Agent Freiberger's dual testimony is that the District Court took corrective action and explained everything to the jury. So if it's an error, why would it not be a harmless error?
The only corrective action, Judge Rovner, that the District Court could have taken to avoid this problem was to completely limit Mr. Freiberger to expert testimony and not allow him to give lay testimony. Because of the unusual way the government presented Agent Freiberger, going through several, at least a day and a half of background on his expertise, qualifying him as a person who had done many drug investigations, who taught about drug investigations and drug code language, they placed upon him the gloss or the special aura of credibility that York and Christian cases warn against.
He is also an eyewitness, so shouldn't he be permitted to testify in his lay capacity as an eyewitness or ear witness?
I think the government had to choose, Judge Posner.
Because why would it be easy for the judge to say to the jury that this fellow, he's studied these drug codes, drug language, and so he can testify about that. In addition, he did listen to some of these tapes, whatever he did. And so he'll testify as to what he heard. So why would that disorient a jury?
Because he was qualified as an expert, and the jury gained evidence or information that he was going to be giving expert.
Often you have a situation, you can have a doctor testifying as an expert witness, but he also might be the treating doctor who testifies to what he saw when he was treating the patient. Why is that so confusing?
I think that's different, Judge Posner.
Why?
A doctor is doing a medical examination where there can't be too many differences
of
opinion.
So officer is listening to tapes, or he has a long history of having done that. So it's like someone testifying about the meaning of foreign words.
But it's fine if he's testifying as a lay witness who was involved in the investigation. But when you put that halo that the cases talk about over his head, that he is an expert, the jury is left with the confusion of what kind of witness is this? And that confusion, I think, is evidenced by the fact that...
I think it's a mistake for judges to talk about lay and expert witnesses and so on. Just tell him, you know, he's going to testify about the meaning of these codes because he has a long history of doing that. And he actually listened to some of this, and he'll tell you about what he heard.
But
why is that,
Judge
so?
Posner, why did Agent Freiberger have to even be qualified as an expert? He answered two questions in this entire trial as an expert. The meaning of zipper.
Well, if what you're concerned about is that the judge allowed the government to harp too much on his... I mean, usually the expert is qualified outside the hearing of the jury.
Of course, that didn't happen here. He was qualified in front of the jury.
Well, that I think you can legitimately object to, but that's different from saying you can't have the same person give both lay and expert testimony.
We feel, Judge, that the court should have told the government you can use Freiberger as your expert or you can use him as a lay witness, not both. I see my time is up. And
okay. Thank you, Mr. Crawford.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will hand the baton off to Ms. Choate.
My client, Jawan Moreland, was acquitted of the conspiracy charge, as you know. The issue as to count three, the gun possession charge, is twofold. First, the issue is, did I, as his attorney, waive the reading of the indictment which contained Mr. Moreland's criminal history?
My question would be, you have so little time that I'd really like to get it, and I'm sorry. My question would be, how should we weigh his acquittal on the conspiracy count when we are trying to decide if he was prejudiced? The first crime she read aloud was possession of cocaine, and yet he's acquitted of the drug count. And again, you know, she gave this immediate corrective instruction. So what I'm trying to figure out is where you think the prejudice is.
I'm very happy to try to address that more thoroughly than perhaps I did in my brief. But the issue is not what the jury did or didn't do. The issue is the strength of the government's case. And it is our position, as my position, as I described in the reply brief, that the government's case as to the gun charge was not strong. And therefore, the error is because the jury was left to speculate as to reasonable doubt. We all know that juries often do compromise decisions, and I believe that that's what happened in the present case.
Can I ask you, what happened to Poltrock? She seems to play a central role in this, or an important role in the entire conspiracy, but she's not mentioned as a defendant.
She did not testify.
Was she prosecuted?
She was.
But not with the... But separately?
Not as a part of these proceedings. And she was on the witness list, and we expected her to testify, but she did not.
Why wasn't she prosecuted with everybody else?
I don't know.
Okay. I'm just curious.
Thank you. My time is up, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Cho. Mr. Donahoe?
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Michael Donahoe. I represented Ontario Hammond at trial and also on appeal. To answer the question you just asked, Jennifer Poltrock was prosecuted along with everyone else, but she entered a plea of guilty prior to trial and was sentenced.
Prior to trial.
Prior to trial, correct. I would like to emphasize something that hasn't been stressed enough in the briefs, and that is part of the record that dispels any notion that any of the defendants, particularly Moreland or Ontario Hammond, acquiesced at all in the reading of the unredacted or the indictment that contained the prior record. The court indicated, this is at page 2171, that she was beginning with the draft that she read to the jury in the open, meaning at the opening of the trial. There was a copy of the indictment read. I think Mr. Blackington read it, and the past record of Hammond and Moreland was taken out. Page 2172, she mentions again that she has that, but she needs to clean it up. And then on page 2174, she says, I'm going to stick with what we read at the beginning just to be consistent. So all the attorneys, all 10 of us, were led to believe she was going to be using the indictment that was read to the jury in the beginning, which had no criminal record whatsoever in it. It's difficult for me to conceive of any event that could occur during a trial that would that would jeopardize a defendant's right to a fair trial above and beyond having his record read to the jury, particularly when it has as many convictions as Mr. Hammond's had, which was five if you count the two counts in one cause number, and also convictions that relate to the crime being deliberated upon. He had several drug charges in there.
You fashioned this as an evidentiary error?
No, it didn't come in as evidence at all. Absolutely. It was a jury influence error, as discussed in Davis and Shiro and the Supreme Court case of Remmer, which this court relied on in its Shiro decision.
So it's a due process argument.
Yes, and it's the same as the event in Shiro where one of the defendants made a remark and there was a concern over whether or not the jury heard it and were influenced.
And the invited error issue comes in because there was a request to the court to read the unredacted version of the indictment during
there
the instruction
by,
phase?
There was by all defendants except my client. We objected to that. But it comes in anyway because what the attorneys were agreeing to was that the same indictment be read to the jury that had been read during opening and that had no criminal records in it whatsoever. And we had addressed this in a motion in limine before trial. We addressed it in a old chief stipulation. We were all on the same page, the court, the government, and the defense, that those records would be kept out. In fact, in its trial brief.
And the judge caught herself in the midst of reading these prior records, but so it was your client's or Ms. Choate's client's partial record that got read to the jury?
It was Ms. Choate's client's partial record that got read. Mine did not get read, but there was some concern. I see my time is up, so I don't want to. But my clients, well, there was some concern that it was on the same page because it wasn't just being read to the jury. They had been handed, like 3 days before this event, a copy of that indictment with that record.
And they had those back in the jury room during that time
yes,
frame?
Yes, they had them back in the jury room. They had them over the weekend, although they had possession of them, but they were in the jury room. They didn't take them home, as far as the judge knew. And we wanted to voir dire the jury to find out whether they had read ahead, whether they had seen it, been influenced, or anything at all like that. And the judge cut us off at the knees and said, we are not going to question them, and ended that. And that's what needed to be done, and that's the error, as far as my client is concerned, the biggest error, because we were never given the opportunity to find out if the jury was exposed to or influenced by those records.
How long did they have this, the original indictment?
It appears that they got them on a Thursday or a Friday, and then I believe this discussion and that it was revealed to us on Monday. And so they had them for some period of time on Thursday and Friday, and then they were apparently left in the courthouse over the weekend, and they had
them
again.
They weren't deliberating. Were they during this period?
No, they had not even been.
So where exactly were the, and was the indictment?
It was contained within their set of instructions.
Pardon?
It was contained within their set of instructions.
A single copy of the indictment.
Well, 12. Each one, every juror had their own.
Okay. Well, they were given the instructions before their deliberations, or what? I mean, before the end of the trial. I just don't get the timetable.
Well, it's my understanding that the court, we settled on final instructions on Thursday or Friday. The court gave those to the jury but didn't read them until Monday. That's my recollection.
What were the jurors doing with the instructions? I don't understand. The judge gave them the instructions before instructing them.
Okay, physically gave them a copy of the written instructions.
What do they do with the copy? What happens to the copy?
According to the court, it was left in the jury room over the weekend.
Well, why the jurors aren't in the jury room over the weekend?
Well, I realize that.
Well, where do the jurors see that?
They had it when it was given to them on.
Saw it?
I'm sorry.
When do you think they saw it?
On Thursday, Friday, and Monday morning.
What kind of time are they spending in the jury room since they're not deliberating?
Well, during sidebars, you know, in the morning, during breaks. But they also had it while they were sitting there, and the judge was reading the instructions, and they held my client's past for a criminal history.
I'm talking about the period before the reading of the instructions.
Okay. As far as I know, it was given to them on Thursday or Friday, and
they have no reason to look at them.
They could have looked at them out of curiosity. That's why it was so important to us to be able to question them.
What's going on in court on Friday?
Status calls. How much time are they in the jury room?
I really don't know. I mean, from the time they get there in the morning until they're called out, then during breaks.
And so there's still evidence being taken?
Maybe I hope counsel for the government can clear this up better than I can. It might have been that we did our closing arguments on Friday and Monday. I really don't remember the timetable.
How long are the instructions?
In pages?
Yeah.
I think about 40 pages, if I remember correctly.
And how long is the indictment?
The indictment was about 9 or 10 pages, if I remember correctly. So
this was somehow sandwiched in with the 40 pages of instructions?
Yes.
40 pages of instructions?
Sure.
Did she read 40? Did the judge read?
Yeah.
How long does it take to read 40 pages of instructions?
About a half an hour.
Sometimes there's one sentence.
Right. And some were rather lengthy. Of course, the indictment was the longest.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Donahoe. Mr. Riggins?
Good morning, Your Honor. I represent Herbert Phipps. I'd like to take a totality view of Mr. Phipps as we look at the circumstances. Mr. Phipps was unique in that when you compare the tools of the trade and the level of trust that is required in order to enter into an agreement, you'll see that Mr. Phipps is substantially different than any of the other people involved in the total operation of Mr. McCombs. Mr. Phipps is on tape doing drug transactions with Dustin McCombs, who was the person who came in and testified. The government relied heavily upon the credit sale under these circumstances, and we look to all of the factors when we take into consideration whether he joined into the conspiracy. What we find is...
So he's fronted three times, and the supplier knew he intended to resell.
That's correct. He has fronted
three times.
He was fronted three times. I'm not sure initially if the seller knew that he intended to resell it. I like to look at it slightly different. What I would say is that Mr. Phipps is consistent with other drug addicts, and what they do is sort of pull their money together. He indicated to Mr. McCombs that what he would do was come over and bring him the money as he was picking up the drugs, but that's not exactly what happened. When he got there, he was short on the money. He asked him, could he go deliver the drugs and then come back? Well, if you look at it from the way we've analyzed this in the past, what side of the transaction is he placed on? Mr. Phipps remains on the same side of the transaction as before, because if you look at more of a co-op style purchase, myself and two other people go in and decide to purchase something that gives us more buying power, and I think that that's what Mr. Phipps was doing under these circumstances. There's nothing else that sort of links him to it. When you look at whether he had any tools of the trade, he had no digital scale, he had no baggies, he had no extensive telephone records or telephone calls that he was making to other people. His only connection in this particular operation was through Dustin McCombs, and Dustin McCombs would look at him more of a wholesale buyer under those circumstances. So when you look at the first two transactions that took place, they were cash on the barrel, and that's what Mr. McCombs was expecting. Mr. Phipps, unlike most of the other people involved in this, was a businessman in the area, and he was known for construction, which means that he got large checks. And when he got those large checks, he would use them to purchase drugs. With the photographs and whatnot, there was no doubt that Mr. Phipps was a heavy methamphetamine user. And in fact, what Mr. Combs did under those circumstances was indicate on the course of the call that, you know, he was worried about the drugs that had been fronted to him. And so he wanted his henchmen to go over there and to check. And you know, he did things like saying that he might, in fact, have to rough Mr. Phipps up. He made other statements. If you look at the comparison with him and the other people in his inner circle, and I went through carefully to ask these questions at the trial court, I asked him, was Mr. Phipps inside your inner circle? And his reply was no. I asked him, did you in fact warn Mr. Phipps of police or law enforcement? He said no. There's nothing in the record to support that he had trust or the level of trust that is required in order for him to join into the conspiracy, which makes him substantially different than anyone else would be here. And I notice my time is up.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Riggins. Ms. Paul?
Thank you. Laura Paul, I'm here for Bradley Shelton. I would like very much to talk with you today about Mr. Shelton's sentence. During the pendency of this appeal, a new case came down from this court, and it changes significantly the way that the district court should have analyzed whether or not he should get a life sentence. That case is Kirkland. and I discussed that in my reply brief. When this case was decided as far as the sentence goes, Hudspeth, as the government pointed out, was the controlling law about how a court should analyze the chronology of convictions. In Mr. Shelton's case, the convictions happened very close in time, and the court considered the charging information, the sentencing order, and the plea agreement, which is now permissible under Kirkland, but it also considered...
But what standard are you proposing?
I think it's clear error now under Kirkland.
No, I don't mean the appellate standard. I mean, when you have a series of crimes in rapid succession, how do you determine whether that should be regarded as one crime or three crimes?
I think that Kirkland makes it clear. You can look at the charging information, the sentencing order, and the plea colloquy or plea agreement. And if the information isn't clear in those documents, then you have to assume that the government did not meet its burden. And I think it was Kirkland that said that it wasn't a high burden. The government has the access to those documents. Those are the documents that can be reviewed. If it isn't clear, then it doesn't apply.
And what do you expect the documents to show?
The documents should show the chronology of the events. In this case, because everything happened so close in time together, that's not clear from the documents in Mr. Shelton's case.
But we know what the intervals were.
But if you look at the permissible documents, it shows the date that the dealing offense occurred, which was the first offense, and then it shows two possession counts. And I think that's key because
But don't we know the interval between them?
The interval is over the course of a week, but the problem
What is the missing information?
I think the fact that the last two were possession cases is...
But that's not missing information. We know they were possession cases. You seem to suggest there's something missing in the documents.
I think there is something missing. We don't know when the possession actually occurred. We only know when it was detected. And they easily could have all happened at the same time. Therefore, those documents are equivocal about the chronology.
Why does the Shepherd rule apply to Section 841?
Because there isn't a lot of case law, I think, on how to determine the chronology in 841 cases.
Well, there's a statute that specifically contemplates an evidentiary hearing, not the limited kind of proof constraints that are on an ACCA recidivist enhancement.
But the ACCA enhancement is a statute, as is the 841-851 enhancement. And most of the case law that is determinative of how to analyze an ACCA case is also applied to the 841-851.
Right, but 851 specifically says that the hearing on the enhancement shall be before the court without a jury, and either party may introduce evidence. That's not the same statutory scheme as in ACCA.
But the ACCA analysis is used for this determining what documents can be used. So
I'm asking whether that's the correct rule. I question whether it is.
I don't know. I would disagree because I think that the case law is pretty clear that ACCA is similar to the 841-851 and the same analysis should be used.
I don't understand the distinction you make between possession and detection. Possession is a continuing offense.
Right.
So it doesn't matter how long he's possessed the stuff. When they detected it, they detected a crime of possession on a certain date, which is different from the date of his original offense.
But the documents don't have any information about when the possession occurred, and if it all occurred...
The possession occurred... They discovered the drugs, right?
And that's when the possession ended.
Well, when they discovered it, that was an act of possession that they detected at that moment. That crime was committed at that moment. It also had been committed previously. There was commission of the crime at that moment.
That's correct, but it was the end of that offense. And
what do you mean, end of that offense? There's no end as long as he's possessing. That's a continuing crime.
and therefore he could have been in possession.
They discovered it 10 years after he started possessing. He's been storing this in his refrigerator for 10 years. He has committed continuously throughout that period the crime of possession. So if 10 years earlier he committed a different crime, and then that interval is that 10 years.
I agree the interval is 10 years. Here it's a week. I think that's different.
Well, if you concede the week, all right, fine. Then there's no missing information. I thought from the beginning of your argument that there was missing information. There was something missing from the documents. But now you're saying we know the chronology, and that's what I wanted to ask you, what I tried to ask you was, what is the standard that determines whether a week is too much or 48 hours or what? What do you want us to say about that?
Well, I think it depends on the offenses that we're talking about. Again, possession
Why?
Is a passive offense.
On the offenses we're talking about.
Many of the cases that discuss this, the application of the ACCA rules, talk about things like robberies and drug deals. Those happen in a very discrete moment. They're active offenses. Somebody makes the decision to do that. Indeed, someone makes the decision to possess a drug, but that happens over an indeterminate period of time. And we're talking about someone's life here. He was sentenced to life because of possession of drugs that happened within a week of dealing eight Xanax
tablets. I know. So you say a week isn't enough. So what standard do you want us to set?
I don't think that a week is enough.
All right. So what should the standard be?
It needs to be longer than a week because...
Well, that's not helpful.
A year.
A year? There's nothing between a week and a year?
6 months? I don't...
That's not an operable standard, you're suggesting.
Well, certainly a week for someone who's an addict, as Mr. Shelton clearly was, is not such a long time.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much, Ms. Paul. So, Mr. Alberts?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I have a very different argument than any of the other arguments you've heard this morning because my client, Michael Ware, is now serving a life in prison because he didn't wear his seatbelt. He was not a suspect in this investigation where the government intercepted thousands of telephone calls, made hundreds of wiretaps, have dozens of pieces of evidence, and his name is not mentioned once.
You know, his situation really might make an interesting habeas case because were you his attorney?
I was not. I'm appointed on appeal, Your Honor. It might make an interesting...
His attorney really dropped the ball on...
Which means it's plain error. It's plain error. Well, and so let's deal with it now rather than on a habeas.
But how do you suggest we get around the plain error standard?
The plain error standard is it clear on its face, and did it affect his substantive rights? It's clear on its face.
Well, now what is the error?
The error is that the evidence was illegally taken from him in violation of Terry.
He's the fellow who was the passenger in the car?
Passenger in a car.
But look, when they stop the car and do their, record check, they realize it's a stolen car.
What they realized was, as I understand the evidence, was she didn't have license, title, or registration. They're going to impound the car and cite her for traffic violation. They ask him to get out of the car. He's not a suspect. He's not a suspect.
No, no.
And when he gets out of the car...
They think the car has been stolen.
He is not a suspect.
They think the car has been stolen.
Your Honor,
correct?
He's not a suspect.
Would you answer my question?
I don't believe the evidence shows that.
They think that the car was stolen.
I don't believe the evidence shows that. The police believed that she had committed a traffic violation and they're going to impound the car. They do not arrest him. Instead, they search him and ask him if he has a weapon. He says, I have a pocket knife in my left front pocket. They then go forward and ask on a Terry frisk. If he has any other weapons, he says no. And in the Terry frisk, the officer says, and I believe him, he immediately recognized it was a wad of cash. A wad of cash is not a weapon. The search should have ended then. They took the cash, which was an illegal search, and what was the result of that, Your Honor? He's now prosecuted. All of the evidence against him, all of the evidence came as a result of that search, because Megan Samuels, in the first interview, all she said was, we use meth together. In the second interview, they ask about the cash, and she says the cash came from him selling drugs, and the rest of it's fruit of the poisonous tree. There is no case against Michael Ware without that violation. And it didn't matter whether the police suspected her of stealing the vehicle. That did not make the money contraband, and that's the standard under Minnesota versus Dickerson. Did they have a reasonable suspicion that that money was contraband? The money, by the way, which was not in plain view, and they knew it was cash.
What was the case against him at trial? Was it all her testimony and the cash?
It was her testimony based on the cash, and then D.J. Pitts, they asked him about whether he'd done had any deals with him, and he said, yeah, I had two or three times I sold to him. Once or twice was fronted. That's it. But without her
testimony.
Was that
independent of her?
No, it came from her. It's fruit of the poisonous tree.
Well, how did they get the Pitts?
Hmm?
How did they get the Pitts? Independent of her?
No, Pitts was part of the charged conspiracy. There is no evidence. It's the government's burden to show that evidence came in independent of her, and the government has not shown that, nor has the government argued that. All of the evidence, he was not a suspect.
Right. No, I get that. I'm trying to get whether there was enough. Whether the plain error standard has been met, whether there's enough independent of her and the cash.
The testimony against him was her, the cash, and statements then made by Michael Ware, which he would not have been a suspect. He wouldn't have made the statements.
Right.
And all he said was, yes, he bought a lot of meth.
Right.
And then statements from Pitts, which were a direct result of the investigation that started because they took the cash. Because they would never have asked her about him. All she said about him was that they used together.
She didn't have title. She didn't have registration. She didn't have insurance, right, when she was arrested?
Correct.
Why they thought the car was stolen.
He was not driving the car.
If they think the car was stolen, they can search the car.
I'm not saying they didn't have a right to search him. They had a right to search him. But the Terry search.
All right, they pat him down. Suppose that, as I'm suggesting, they think the car is stolen. They pat him down. They realize that, which they're allowed to do, they realize there's a wad of cash. So now they have what they think is a stolen car and a guy with a huge wad of cash. Now, isn't that enough for them to search the car?
No. They had no basis to suspect Mr. Ware of any criminal activity.
They do. Look, if they think the car is stolen, and they've got the two people in the car, and one has a big wad of cash, these are suspicious circumstances.
The explanation the officer gave at trial was he wasn't wearing his seatbelt. That's why they stopped the car. She didn't have registration. They're going to impound the car and cite her. They then did the search, and they found the cash which they took from him, and they did not arrest him, which indicates their mens rea at that time. Their thought process was, he's not a suspect. If he was a suspect, why wasn't he arrested, Your Honor? And the rest of it led to all the evidence against him, which led to a life in prison. Because if he had worn his seatbelt.
Life in prison is not an issue.
It is an issue,
rules,
Your Honor.
Look, the Fourth Amendment is not about the protection of innocent people. This is not an innocent person. If the sentence is improper, it would be improper on the basis of his guilt and what he was guilty of, not how evidence against him was obtained.
My understanding is, Your Honor, the Fourth Amendment is...
That has nothing to do with life imprisonment. There's no connection between a Fourth Amendment violation and a sentence challenged as too long.
If the Fourth Amendment violation led to the evidence,
you're missing the point.
Illegal
this
conviction.
Has nothing to do with the length of the sentence.
I've made a separate argument.
I don't understand that much. It has nothing to do with the length of the sentence. It has to do with guilt. With a conviction, not with a sentence.
The amendment applies whether you...
understand?
I do understand,
Your
Honor.
It has to do with a conviction. So don't waive the life imprisonment in front of us, all right? Because it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. And your time has expired.
Thank you.
So we'll hear from the government, Mr. Blackington.
Thank you. May it please the court.
Why don't you start with Weir, because this, you know, this is a very questionable search. So what was the justification for?
I think the biggest problem with the Weir search is this: there is no motion to suppress filed before trial. There is no objection made at trial to the introduction of the evidence. So the result of that is this issue is never.
No, I understand that. So is that your only? So are you not defending the search on the merits, but instead relying on the lack of?
I would defend the search on the merits, Your Honor. The problem is the record isn't fully developed.
Well, what's
about
your
why
best evidence that drugs were fronted to Mr. Weir? I'm just so frankly surprised that the girlfriend's testimony didn't draw some foundation objection. She admitted to not actually seeing any of this, and yet she's allowed to testify. What was going on there?
Her testimony was that the drugs were fronted to Mr. Weir, and she learned that because Mr. Weir would go to locations where his sources of supply had drugs. He'd go into the house, not have drugs.
But
he'd
she walk admitted into, not to having seen any of this. That's
yes. If I could continue, please. He would walk into a house, not have drugs. She would see him go into another room, meet with Mr. Pitts or Mr. McCombs, and then come out with drugs. So, you know, the inference is if you go into a room and you don't have drugs and you come out and then you do and that's the only person you meet with, the inference is that that's the person you got drugs from.
What does that have to do with fronting?
And I think it's reasonable. And she also said she would drive around with him for different parts of the day. When he would collect money from people that he had fronted meth to pay off his suppliers who had fronted him. So they'd, you know, be in the car, talk in the car. She'd observe and what he did and said.
So she saw those subsidiary transactions?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Is there any evidence that the police thought this was a stolen car?
There isn't in the record, again, because it wasn't...
Because it wasn't an issue at the time.
Yeah, it wasn't an issue at the time, and I didn't ask those questions, Your Honor. And in the absence of a motion to suppress, I didn't feel the need to do that at trial. But
I still need to understand how that cash... during a pat-down for weapons, was automatically and obviously contraband.
I think because you're...
You didn't respond to any of the questions that Mr. Weir's attorney cited a number of cases for the proposition that cash by itself is not contraband. You didn't respond to any of those cases.
I think a large amount of cash that's rolled up in a pocket, it's at the very early morning hours. You're in a vehicle that I think, as the court has said, you look at the surrounding circumstances. The police have reason to believe the vehicle's stolen, that it's contraband. I'm a little hamstrung here because, again, there was not a motion to suppress filed. And so I never asked the officer during the trial, officer, did you think the money was, what did you think the money was? Did you think it was contraband or not? I didn't do that because that issue wasn't before the court at the time. So, you know.
Right. Okay, we understand.
That's the big problem here.
Now, it is true, isn't it, that in 7,000 taped phone calls, 7,000, his name and his voice are not heard a single time.
That's because he was in jail while the wiretap was going on.
The entire time?
Yes.
But, you know, someone might, in 7,000 calls, say household where doing it.
They didn't.
Were all his calls taped by the jail?
His calls from the jail, yeah, they would have been.
Their practice.
Yes. But his calls weren't intercepted in the wiretap. He was in jail.
Can you add any detail to this problem of the unredacted instructions? How likely it was that jurors would have looked at them? I didn't get the chronology.
I can add to it, Your Honor. And I'd the part in the record that the court could examine to address that part starts in page 2265 of the transcript. And what had happened was the closing arguments in the case were given over 2 days before the final instructions were read to the jury. Page 2260.
Was that Thursday and Friday?
My recollection would be yes. So what the judge did was the judge handed out copies of the instructions that she wanted the jury to be able to look at in case the lawyer cited to them. And when you look at page 2265, it says, good morning, what you found in the chairs when you come back to the final instructions or the instructions. I don't recall them ever going back to the jury room or the jury read them. I'm not going to tell you that I remember with absolute certainty, but the court put the instructions on the jurors' chairs so that if during, let's say, my argument, I wanted to refer to the buyer and seller instruction, they could read them and follow them along. I don't think they went back to the jury, but I'd confess I could be completely
wrong. You don't think the instructions went back to the jury?
Not at the point where counsel were referring to them in closing argument. Now, after they were given to the jury at the end of the closing argument, then they went back to the jury. But I don't believe they went back to them before the instructions were given.
Could we talk about Mr. Phipps, because he seems to have an argument here that the government failed to prove more than a buyer-seller arrangement. What I'm trying to figure out is what your best evidence is that he joined the agreement. I mean, I know that he received drugs on credit on 3 occasions, but just as often he had to pay up front. And this idea that he's on the same side of a sale to a third party, I mean, it seems like a stretch. He's an addict. They know he's going to sell some and use some. Where is the evidence of conspiracy? Because if there was, then sales of amounts greater than personal use would always, always be conspiracy. And I don't think we've gone that far yet. And it seems to me that Mr. Phipps was sort of looking out for Mr. Phipps. And no one in this conspiracy is looking out for Mr. Phipps. So if you could give me your best evidence.
My best evidence is direct evidence, and that direct evidence is the telephone calls between Dustin McCombs and Herb Phipps, where McCombs has fronted methamphetamine to Phipps. Phipps is asking for methamphetamine to sell to his customers. There's an explicit understanding that there are customers that Mr. Phipps is selling to, and as this court said over and over in Johnson, Cologne, some of the recent cases, and I quote, all that is necessary to establish a drug distribution conspiracy is a mutual understanding related to the subsequent distribution of narcotics. So when McCombs gives the meth to Phipps, and
what does that mean? I don't understand that. If you sell to someone who's an intermediate, if you sell to a retailer, say, you know the retailer is going to be selling it, reselling it. That's his business. So what's this mutual understanding?
Well, that's...
It's still a buyer-seller relationship when you sell to someone who's who's a retailer instead of the ultimate consumer.
Well, if you look at the Rock case, for instance, if there's an ascertained customer of Mr. Phipps, or it's they're identified customers of Mr. Phipps.
What does that have to do with the conspiracy? It's the customer.
That was the basis for the court's ruling and finding a conspiracy in Rock.
I don't understand the sense of it. Why the existence of a... Why the fact that you're selling to a retailer means that you're conspiring with him. You're just selling to him.
Well, in this case...
He doesn't care about your business. He just he buys from you and he...
In this case, Your Honor, of course, the crime's an agreement to distribute drugs. And if person A and if person B comes to person A and says, hey, I need drugs to deliver to person C, and person A says, here you go, that's an agreement.
Yes, but it's just a purchase agreement.
And it's an agreement to distribute because they both have agreed that person C is going to get the drugs.
Okay, but now you're saying that every drug sale to a retailer or other distributor is a conspiracy.
No, I'm not. I'm only saying that.
What would be the exception?
Well, I'm saying if there's not express evidence that both person A and B, the two members of the conspiracy, if there's not express evidence that they both know and both join in the understanding that person B is going to distribute it.
You can have someone who goes to a who goes to a drugstore and buys toothpaste, right? There's an understanding. There's a sales transaction. You wouldn't call it a conspiracy.
Right, because there's no understanding between the person behind the store at Rite Aid and the person who gets the toothpaste that the person who gets the toothpaste is going to resell it. And here you have an explicit...
What if you say to the... What if you say to the store, you know, I need to buy a bunch of tubes of toothpaste for my family, friends of mine. They're going to reimburse me.
And there's a mutual understanding that the toothpaste would be resold, and
that
that's
makes what everybody who shops at Costco a co-conspirator.
I would say not quite.
Those are bulk quantities.
There's more here than just a bulk quantity, though. There are discussions about Herb Phipps' ongoing dealing to customers. There are discussions between...
How many telephone calls are we talking about?
That were played at trial?
No, with Phipps mentioned out of 7,000.
I'm going to say 15.
Out of 7,000.
Well, there were 220 or so played at trial. There may be 15, 20 with Phipps. I'd have to count them to...
The emphasis was not on the fact of resale, but on credit, extending credit, notion you need mutual trust, and so on. And
that's their present, and here we do a fronting, but I was asked specific questions, and I think you have...
In a more extreme position, you're saying even if there's no credit involved, the fact that the supplier knows that his purchaser is going to resell, that's enough to create a conspiracy.
And that there's an explicit understanding that he's going to resell, and that...
What an understanding means, if you tell the supplier that you're a retailer, or if you simply buy in a quantity which makes it obvious that you resell, what more in the way of an understanding is necessary?
What I'm looking at and what I was reading was the exact language of this court used
in
Johnson.
The fact that there's exact language in a judicial decision doesn't mean that it's right.
Okay. then I think
there's other language in that opinion also. It doesn't all necessarily turn on...
What, you know, look, he has to pay up front as often as he's allowed credit. Probably allowed credit more. And there's really, I just don't see the signs that he's part of some larger group. I mean, he's an addict. He's buying for himself, and he's maybe selling a little to be able to pay for the amounts that he used.
Let me address a few things. First, it's being fronted to him. Second, you've heard all this stuff's in the brief that he's just an addict and he's just trying to rip off Mr. McCombs. None of that. The only testimony we had in trial about him being an addict is that he had bad teeth. Okay? And the only testimony, we had no testimony at all about him trying to rip off Mr. McCombs. That was argument from counsel that had no basis from the evidence. And in fact,
you know, what's missing here is what we had in a recent case where the purchaser, who was the reseller, he noticed police, I think, he noticed the police having arrested someone in the chain of distribution, and he went and warned a distributor, the higher distributor. Okay, so that suggested that he was more than just a buyer. He was part of a scheme, and he was protecting his supplier from the police, which is more than just buying, right? That's the sort of thing we don't seem to have here, something more than just quantity and just the fact that you know the person is a retailer.
And I understand. I'm sure the court's not taking the position you need to give a warning to have a conspiracy. But I think the key thing here, and we could talk about the mutual understanding, and I understand where the court's coming from. But here we also have fronting, and the cases from this court have suggested that fronting's the most important factor in distinguishing between a buyer-seller agreement and a conspiracy, and we've got that here.
Had he been fronted once?
Three times.
I know, but had he been, would that have been enough?
I would say no, because I think the language this court's used in most of its opinions, repeated fronting, and to me that means so, more than once.
So twice, would that... Would that be enough?
I guess that'd be repeated. It depends how we stress the word, but I think
that depends. So what a difference a day makes.
Sure. I think it's you have to look at these situations, and particularly the phone calls between the two. You've got them talking explicitly about Phipps's efforts to redistribute the meth and collect the money, and when you put that in fronting together.
Do we have any sense, this is picking up on Judge Rovner's question, three out of how many?
Six.
So half of the known transactions were fronted. It's not like it was 3 out of 100 or something.
That's correct, Your Honor. If I could move to just a couple of other issues that I wanted to talk about, unless the court has further questions. The notion of dual testimony, and I just want to correct what the court had said. The judge did not take corrective actions about dual testimony, because the phrase corrective action implies something's wrong. And in fact, this court sanctioned that type of thing repeatedly in York and other cases. What happened was there were two words used, zippers and stepped on, that
yeah,
were expert.
Yeah, but forgive me. I'm interrupting you. I know. I'm sorry. But I'm concerned about jury confusion with his testimony. I can't think of another case where a jury has sent a question to the judge asking for clarification while a witness is testifying. What do we do with that? It's awfully hard to argue that this didn't confuse the jury when they took this virtually unprecedented action. I don't know, maybe it happens. It certainly didn't happen when I was on the district court, or I haven't seen it here. of telling a judge mid-trial, we're confused. And all you really seem to have done with your qualifying questions was to boost his credibility on his non-expert testimony. And I don't understand why he had to be qualified as an expert. A lay witness could have testified to the meaning of step on and the meaning of zipper. I'm really...
I don't think so. When the jury asked that question, we hadn't asked any expert witnesses questions yet. And the judge said, no, he hasn't talked about... he hasn't given expert testimony yet. So if there was any confusion up to then, it was gone.
But he'd been qualified as an expert in front of them.
No. The judge did not qualify him at that point, took it under advisement.
What did the judge say to the jury about the different about lay and expert testimony?
Because in reading York, the court suggested in York that we take deliberate measures to cordon off expert testimony from lay testimony. And so what happened in that case, when I did ask an expert question, I told the court we're going in this area of an expert witness questioning. The court then instructed the jury about the difference between expert and lay. And that's what the court said to do in York.
I don't understand why that's a useful thing to say to jurors. Frankly, Your Honor,
that's two of us. But in York, that's what this court said to do, so that's the practice I followed, and that's, I'm sure, why the court followed that
that's
practice.
The problem arises in this artificial distinction between case agent testimony about case-specific drug slang and case agent testimony about general drug slang, and whether that's a distinction that has any real
And I
real
agree
meaning.
With the court. I agree 100%, but there are a lot of cases that say differently. And
do you agree enough to agree that we should back off some of this?
I think
our
so.
Opportunity.
I think so, because it's exactly like what this court said. I used to do, before I became a federal prosecutor, I used to do a lot of black lung cases in western Pennsylvania. And it'd always be the same thing. You'd put the treating physician on. You'd go through his background, and the physician would say, look, I looked at the pulmonary records. I looked at the x-rays. There's both something as simple as a cocaine test. You know, it's hard to say, you know, okay, I looked at this sample of cocaine. It's cocaine. You know, that's both based on my experience and my present. I agree. I'd love to see the court back off of that.
Oh, what a beautiful morning.
Yeah, I'd love to see the court do it, and I think it's appropriate. I really do, because, I think any time you have an expert in these things, simple things, drug chemists, black lung cases, whatever opinion, there's always a mix of what I've learned in the past and my examination in this case. I agree. But, you know, in this situation, that's what York told us to do, so that's what we did. I see that my time's up. There are other things I'd love to talk about, but looks like there are more people than me. So does the court have any questions?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
So the time of the defendant's lawyers have expired. Of course, I realize we didn't give you a lot of time. If any of you have something you think is very important, we'll give you a minute. Yes. Mr. Albers, yeah.
You heard from...
Right, about the procedural issue.
You heard from the government that there's no evidence in this record of any suspicion of it being a stolen vehicle.
I thought you were going to address his claim that this was never raised at the trial.
I am addressing it wasn't raised, and I've raised it as plain error. And on that issue, you asked the government, and the government said there is no record And he says he tries to turn the issue on his head.
What Mr. Blackington said was that since no objection was made, the government didn't prepare its, you know, ask the police whether they thought the car was stolen.
But he can't use that to suggest there is such evidence. There is no. It's not my burden.
No, it's the government's burden to have admissible evidence.
No,
you're missing something. The government doesn't have to present evidence on a non-issue, right? If you don't raise an issue, they don't have to say anything about it. They have the money in evidence. No one's objecting to it, so they don't prepare a case. That doesn't mean they don't have the evidence or couldn't produce it. They had no need for it.
I'm suggesting,
there's no objection.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm suggesting something different. I'm suggesting that the government has conceded that there is no evidence.
No, he has not conceded
this
that.
This record.
What he said was that the government didn't present evidence because Weir's lawyer didn't make an objection.
And this is plain error because there is no question that that was an illegal search because it was not contraband. And there's no way that the police could have known it was contraband at that time. And that's how it's measured.
No.
That's what I wanted to say in rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Ms. Paul?
Your Honor, Judge Posner, you asked me what the standard should be,
yeah.
And I didn't have a very good answer for you. But upon reflection, in Indiana, the habitual offender statute has a provision which requires convictions to be separated or offenses to be separated by an actual conviction.
By?
An actual conviction and sentencing. And I would suggest that that would be an excellent standard because especially in the case of Mr. Shelton where possession of drugs is the issue, that would indicate that he really did have an opportunity to rehabilitate himself and step away from his criminal activity.
These weren't separate convictions?
No, he was sentenced on the same day.
Well, but they're separate counts of conviction.
Yes, but
in the same judgment is your
yes,
point.
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct. That's correct. Okay. So that would be the standard I would suggest. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Riggins, is that correct?
Donahoe.
No, I'm sorry.
On behalf of Ontario Hammond. After listening to Mr. Blackington, my recollection was a little bit refreshed about how things went, and it is my recollection now that we had closing arguments on Thursday and Friday. The judge did want the jury to have a full set of instructions at that time. We had already settled on the instructions before. What we had been provided did not contain a copy of this indictment. We had a blank page or brackets that said indictment will be read here, something to that effect. So without the opportunity to question the jurors, as we requested and the judge denied, it's impossible to tell whether they read ahead, how much time they had, whether they became exposed to Mr. Hammond's convictions, whether they were influenced at all by that, and whether or not there was a request from counsel, and there was one in this case, the court has an obligation
to do that. Well, Mr. Blackington said that he thought, although he wasn't sure, that the instructions were placed on the jurors' chairs, but they didn't take them back to the jury room.
Well, I think that I'm not sure what he meant, whether he said they didn't take them back at any time at all, but again, we can concede.
On Thursday and Friday, I mean.
Okay, that may be true. The judge thought that they were remained. She says in the record that she thought they stayed in the jury room over the weekend, so somebody had to take them back there.
Right.
I don't know. And then
the jurors wouldn't be there over the weekend.
They wouldn't be there, no, but they would have had constructive possession for all the time and actual physical possession for a great deal of that time. When
I have one question. Were there two sets of redactions to the indictment? Did the court have three versions, in other words?
Well, there was the original indictment that had everything in it. Then there was the indictment that the court read to the jury initially in opening or at the beginning of the trial as part of the preliminary instructions, and that had the overt acts taken out and our client's records taken out.
Why were their criminal records in the instructions?
They were only in the indictment.
I mean, I'm sorry.
Oh, well,
why
because
were they in the indictment?
Hammond
yeah.
and Moreland were charged with under 922G with being felons in possession, and whoever drafted the indictment decided to list all of their felony convictions in there to prove to state that element of the offense.
Were there two or three?
Oh, so anyway, then there was the one that the court read at the end, which included everything.
So three?
So, I guess so.
Three sets?
Yeah. And only the last one, the one that was given to the jury, had the criminal histories in there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Donahoe. Anything further? Were all of you appointed?
Yes.
Well, we thank you very much for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client.